Welcome, everyone, to today's Clue-In Seminar. Again, my name is Jean Balance, and I'm coming to you from the EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as your online moderator for today's session. Our seminar today has been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, and is part of a seminar series called NARPM Presents, which will look at a number of topics or presentations that have been hosted at the NARPM conference, or NARPM training session, in the past year or so. And we're going to do a number of seminars as part of that series throughout the summer here on Clue-In. Today's kickoff session in that series will take a look at RCRA for RPMs. And again, this session will explain the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act, or RCRA, requirements that apply and or are relevant and appropriate to most cleanups under the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liability Act, or CERCLA. Our session today will focus on the specific technical and regulatory issues that RPMs, or remedial project managers, will address in treating, transporting, and disposing of waste. Again, our main presenter today will be Dave Phillips from Tetra Tech EMI. I'm going to cover a couple of housekeeping items and then formally introduce our presenter so that we can start the technical portion of our broadcast. When you signed up for today's Internet seminar, you would have been directed to the seminar homepage. And for those of you that have gone to the seminar homepage, you have hopefully either downloaded a copy of the presentation materials as either a PowerPoint or PDF, or have clicked the button on the seminar homepage that appears in the upper left corner that says Go to Seminar. That button would allow you to check yourself in and kind of identify anybody who's sharing the line with you, and then actually pull up the slides in a web browser window. So everyone should be looking at slide number one, the title slide. I'm going to go ahead and ask everybody to move along to the next slide, slide number two in the presentation deck, our housekeeping slide. If you haven't guessed it, today's session is going to be working with the older or classic Clue-In seminar platform. So today's session will actually require each attendee to manually advance through the materials at verbal cues from our speaker. Again, you can find these materials on the seminar homepage. You also would have been reminded on how to access those materials in a reminder email from me in just the past day or so. So refer back to one of those, either the confirmation or reminder emails for these materials if you don't have them. As we go through the materials today, our speaker will indicate when it's time to turn the page. And if you have a PowerPoint or PDF copy, you'll simply click to advance to the next slide. For those of you that are looking at the slides online through a web browser window, you'll have the option to either use the numbered links that appear to the left-hand slide or side. I'm on slide number two right now. Or you'll use a series of orange icons or buttons that appear along the top of the slide deck. The single arrow pointing to the right in those orange buttons will move you forward one slide. The single arrow pointing to the left will move you backwards one slide. We will be taking Q&A with our presenter, and in fact, we encourage participants to type up their comments and questions at any point during today's session. If you look at those orange icons again, I'll draw your attention to one that has a question mark in it. It should appear towards the upper right portion of the button. If you make sure your pop-up blockers have been disabled, when you click that orange question mark icon, a new window will open up, which will allow you to privately submit a comment or question. And then I'll queue those questions up until we take breaks for Q&A, and I'll read them out loud, and then our presenter will be able to answer them for you. Again, you don't need to wait until the breaks to type up your questions. You can go ahead and do that at any time. If you want to test that feature out, please go ahead and do that. I'm the only one who can view the questions and comments. If you're having any technical problems, you'll also feel free to use that Q&A window to report the problems you're having. Just be sure to include a telephone number where we can reach you so we can help troubleshoot those issues. Today's session is going to be recorded and will be archived in approximately 1 week. You'll automatically get an email as soon as that session is available for free download and replay. And you feel free to forward it on to any coworkers that you think will find this to be a valuable expenditure of their time. If you'd like, you can currently take a look at the over 500 sessions that are available for free replay on our Clue-In archive page, which again is shown at the bottom of slide two. The final reminder, and it looks like everybody is being gracious and is already doing that right now, is to keep those of you on the telephone line to remain on a mute. If I hear any audio disruptions, I'll turn on a global mute, but I prefer if each individual participant can keep their own lines muted. You can either use your own mute button or simply hit star 6 to mute your line. When we take breaks for questions, if you're on the telephone line, I'll invite you to come off of mute, and I'll remind you how you can come off of mute at that point. But otherwise, I'd ask that you remain muted on the telephone lines to cut down on background noises. So it looks like that's the end of the reminders that I have for today's session. So I'm going to direct everyone to move along to slide number three, which is labeled Module 1. It's the beginning of the technical portion of today's broadcast. I'm going to turn things over to Dave Phillips from Tetra Tech, who is a chemical engineer and regulatory analyst with more than 23 years of environmental consulting experience, focused on the implementation of RCRA CERCLA and the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act. He has primarily supported EPA and other federal departments and agencies and state regulatory agencies in rulemakings, program analysis, developing policies and guidance, as well as in site assessment, permitting, inspections, and enforcement regulations. Mr. Phillips serves as a subject matter expert in developing and delivering training on RCRA CERCLA and the, again, Dave, you're going to have to tell me, how do you pronounce that acronym? Is it EPCRA?
EPCRA. Yeah.
Okay. Great topics. He began his environmental career as an information specialist and training director for EPA's RCRA Superfund hotline. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to Dave. Again, everyone, we're starting on slide number 3.
Okay. Thank you, Jean. Welcome, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, depending on what part of the country you are in. We have 2 hours here to kind of briefly go over the Resource Conservation Recovery Act. Specifically, what we've tried to focus on are those parts of RCRA that are relevant to remedial project managers performing response actions under authority of CERCLA or Superfund. This is a presentation we've kind of we've given several times at the NARPA, National Association of Remedial Project Managers, conference over the years. And so we've kind of consolidated a few things, but there's basically 3 things we're going to try to accomplish here. First is a brief overview of the Resource Conservation Recovery Act, why it's relevant to RPMs who are performing cleanups under Superfund authority. And then we're going to focus on 3 major areas that you typically are going to have to deal with RCRA in the course of implementing your response. And the first one would be determination of whether something's a hazardous waste or not, or what we call waste determination, waste characterization. So that's a big area that we'll focus on. And then after that, the other 2 areas which we'll talk a little bit more about are the RCRA land disposal restrictions requirements. If something's defined or as a hazardous waste, it's most likely subject to the RCRA land disposal restrictions requirements. And that involves determining whether what treatment standards apply to the waste, what your obligations are with respect to manage that waste on-site or off-site to meet those treatment standards. And then we'll also discuss some RCRA technical standards that apply to different types of units or management methods that you would use, you might use at a response action. And what I'm really talking about is the requirements for the design operation of tank systems, containers, several types of units that were created specifically under the RCRA's cleanup program, corrective action program, but are commonly used in the Superfund world too. Things called temporary units, corrective action management units, and staging piles. So the 3 things that we're going to focus on again are, with respect to RCRA, is waste identification, how to determine whether something's a hazardous waste or not, RCRA land disposal restrictions requirements, and then some special rules and policies with regards to the units or methods of managing waste both on-site and off-site. With that, let's go ahead and flip to the next slide and briefly go through why RCRA requirements are important to RPMs. Well, clearly, the first one is it defines what's a hazardous waste and not, and what's not a hazardous waste. So from that standpoint, and that's a major focus of this seminar here, or webinar, I should say, is why it's relevant. It's a common question that you encounter. Most response actions generate some type of waste, and you need to determine what the regulatory requirements apply to that. RCRA is commonly one that comes into play, and so it's important from the standpoint of determining what's hazardous waste versus what's non-hazardous waste. The second thing is, as RCRA establishes many and oftentimes a large majority of what would be defined as the action-specific, applicable or relevant, and appropriate requirements for on-site management. So if something's defined as a hazardous waste, RCRA requirements will be applicable to its on-site management. Obviously, they'll be applicable to its off-site management as well. And oftentimes, even if something's not defined as a hazardous waste, RCRA technical management standards may be considered relevant and appropriate for managing that particular waste on-site. Anytime you send any waste off-site, those of you who are familiar with the Superfund program, you have to comply with all applicable requirements. And RCRA hazardous waste, when they're sent off-site, there's some very specific requirements with regards to packaging, preparing the waste for transportation off-site, complying with some transportation requirements, which we'll touch briefly at the end of this seminar, and sending the waste, the hazardous waste, to facilities that are permitted under RCRA authority to accept those wastes. And only facilities that have, the conditions in their permit to accept certain RCRA waste streams may manage them. And again, this is another reason why you have to be aware of RCRA, because it can affect your selection of your treatment, storage, and disposal facility that will receive the waste off-site. And finally, RCRA as an ARR plays an important role in affecting costs and also your strategy with respect to characterizing, treating, storing, and disposing of waste generated during response actions. In particular, if wastes are defined as hazardous in conjunction with compliance with the applicable land disposal treatment standards, it can significantly increase the costs for management of those wastes. As most of you probably know, managing waste streams that are defined as RCRA hazardous typically will cost several times more than those wastes that are defined as non-hazardous. So understanding which waste streams are defined as hazardous and not will clearly affect your strategy as well as your costs for managing those wastes as they're generated during the response action. Let's now switch to the next slide, and this is entitled Overview of RCRA, and it's just a quick primer, if you will, on what the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act is. It's a rather old statute in that it was enacted back in 1976, and it actually amended the existing Solid Waste Disposal Act, so sometimes you'll hear it referred to as the Solid Waste Disposal Act. And it established a national program, or national authority, federal authority, for addressing problems associated with improper management of solid and hazardous waste. And you can see there we've listed some of the congressional goals in establishing the ACTA. We're going to focus mostly on the first one there, which is protect human and health and the environment from hazards posed by improper waste disposal, specifically hazardous wastes. The idea was RCRA was to regulate by identifying and establishing regulations for the proper management of hazardous waste generated by active industrial facilities. The idea being that if waste were properly managed, you would not have future liability and cleanup problems as a result. This is a primary goal of RCRA. The next slide, entitled Statutory Framework of RCRA. Just as I mentioned earlier, RCRA amended the previous Solid Waste Disposal Act, and there have been several major amendments to RCRA that have occurred through the years, the most important one being the Hazardous and Solid Waste Amendments of 1984, which really was Congress's as well as EPA's response to the initial implementation of the RCRA program in the early 1980s. Created a number of the programs, some of which we'll talk about, such as the land disposal restrictions. The authority for that program or that came from the Hazardous and Solid Waste Amendments. One of the other big changes that occurred under HISWA, as it's often called, to RCRA was RCRA was originally established as a preventative program to ensure proper management of hazardous waste. But HISWA also provided authority, a cleanup authority, to RCRA, which we call corrective action. And often, sometimes you guys will hear this in the Superfund world as well, but the corrective action, the cleanup authorities under RCRA apply to RCRA-regulated treatment storage and disposal facilities or those facilities who may have or were required to obtain something called interim status at a particular time. There's an order authority which can be used to compel cleanups. And these are used at facilities with an active owner-operator to address issues at those RCRA-regulated facilities. Since 1984, there hasn't been major significant amendments to the RCRA law. So it's a mature statute. The RCRA statute includes 10 subtitles, but there are three major regulatory programs that are authorized by, created by RCRA. One for solid waste, which is under subtitle D. The hazardous waste regulatory program, which comes from subtitle C of RCRA, and that's our focus today. And then there was a third program, which was added by the hazardous and solid waste amendments, subtitle I, which dealt with underground storage tanks, gasoline stations, other tanks, underground storage tanks, holding products. Flip to the next slide and look at the regulatory framework for implementing Subtitle C of RCRA. Subtitle C provides the legal authority for EPA to create and administer a hazardous waste regulatory program. And Congress provided the administrator of EPA broad authority to issue regulations on the identification of hazardous waste and management regulations to ensure proper and safe management of hazardous waste to prevent harm to human health and the environment. And as I mentioned earlier, it also established authority for a corrective action or cleanup program, which is applicable to certain RCRA-regulated facilities, those ones that are required to have permits or interim status, which was essentially a legal mechanism that allowed facilities without permits to operate as if they had permits until a permit disposition was made by EPA or the state. The federal regulations implementing RCRA are found in 40 CFR Parts 260 through 279, and we'll be referring to the important regulations for waste identification and land disposal restrictions as we go along. And if you flip to the next slide, we're going to look at the state's role in the implementation of RCRA. Currently, 48 states and some of the territories all have been delegated authority by EPA under RCRA to implement the RCRA regulatory requirements. So the states are the primary entities, the regulatory agencies who administer and enforce RCRA requirements within their states. The two states that I know of that do not have current RCRA authorization are Iowa and Alaska, I believe, has also turned their program back over to NEPA Region 10, is managing and implementing a program in the state of Alaska. Just a couple of things here, because when you're dealing with AWARs, well, you the states identify their AWARs, submit to them, so oftentimes you'll be referring to the state RCRA requirements where the state has been authorized. EPA still maintains a role and is authorized to continue to develop new regulations under RCRA authority. And the important thing to understand here is depending on what authority EPA uses to promulgate any new regulations under RCRA, they may or may not take effect in the state depending on the state's authorization and what RCRA authority EPA used to issue that regulation. That's a mouthful. But the bottom line is this, is that if EPA issues a new rule under the hazardous and solid waste authorities that were added to RCRA, that rule goes into effect in all the states at the same time. And EPA will retain enforcement or implementation of that rule until the states adopt it, become authorized for it. Now, in some cases, EPA has been making changes or proposing changes to the RCRA program using the original RCRA authority. And, for example, the redefinition of solid waste. Maybe some of you are familiar with this or you've heard about this before. And this deals with waste streams that are recycled and whether or not they can be potentially regulated ultimately as hazardous waste under RCRA. If EPA were to issue a final rule or has issued final rules under that, the original RCRA authority, if a state's authorized and the rule is less stringent than the existing standards, the state can choose not to adopt it. Point is that sometimes you may have a new regulation that comes up, and again, depending on the authority that was used, RCRA authority that was used to issue it, and the state's authority to implement the program, that rule may or may not be in effect. So it's just something to watch out for, particularly if there's a change that's been made which results in the regulations being less stringent than what they used to be. The other thing to be aware of is some state programs, those of you who are in Region 9 or work with the state of California, state environmental laws and regulations can be more stringent and broader in scope than the federal program, but they're only applicable within that state. So some states, and I don't mean to pick on California, but that's the most common one, is they've identified a number of waste streams that, for example, may be excluded from the definition of hazardous waste federally, but they may be defined as hazardous waste within the state. And so, therefore, the state program is more stringent and they require management as a California hazardous waste. So be aware of that. In other cases, some states go beyond the federal management requirements and may have more stringent requirements. For example, they may require secondary containment in some situations for like container storage areas where the federal regulations don't refer to that, require that. So again, be aware that the state regulations where your response action is occurring may be more stringent, more broader in scope than the federal program. So let's now move to Module 2, which is hazardous waste determination. As Jean mentioned when she was talking about my background, I used to work on the RCRA Superfund hotline many years ago. And as the hotline, we received about 300,000 calls a year back then. This is, I don't want to date myself too much, but this is in the mid-1980s, late 1980s. I'd say about 60% of our questions were on whether something was a hazardous waste or not. And so this is, and even in all these years teaching RCRA to CERCLA folk, this is still a very basic question and is the most important one. So flip into the next slide, which is entitled Hazardous Waste Determination Basics. Determining whether something's a hazardous waste or not is an issue that almost always has to be addressed during your CERCLA response action. Now, at least in most CERCLA responses, you're going to generate some sort of waste stream. And so determining whether it's hazardous waste or not, potentially regulated under RCRA, is a common occurrence. In order to for something to be regulated as a hazardous waste, obviously has to be defined as a hazardous waste. So the hazardous waste determination process is a prerequisite for RCRA applicability. The rules that EPA has established and that Congress authorized for determining whether something is a hazardous waste involves four basic steps, which we'll get to in just a second. But before you go to the regulations, and I emphasize this, this is probably the most important take-home message here with respect to the hazardous waste determination section. Before you get into the regulations, which can be very confusing, especially the definition of solid waste, try to answer three questions first about the waste stream or the contaminated environmental media that you're addressing, that you need to manage. And these three questions are, what is it, how is it produced, and what are you going to do with it? How are you going to manage it? Again, those three questions are critically important. What is it, How was it produced? And what are you going to do with it? I say that simply because if you change any of those answers to those three questions, you may get a different answer as to whether it's a hazardous waste or not under RCRA. A common example is I can have three piles of dirt with the same concentration of benzene in it. And depending on how that benzene got in there, okay, and what I'm going to do with it, one pile of dirt may be regulated as a hazardous waste, another one might not be. So it's very important for all the waste streams that you manage, that you generate, that you answer those three questions before you turn to the regulations in order to determine whether or not they're hazardous wastes. So, last time I'll repeat it here. What is it? How is it produced? Okay, and what am I going to do with it? Now, the second question on how was it produced is sometimes problematic in answering during a CERCLA response action, because a lot of times you don't know how this, you know, exactly how the benzene got into the soil. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in just a few minutes on how you can address that. But again, I can't emphasize the importance of answering those three questions before you start looking in the regulations. The other thing with RCRA, like all environmental laws, federal environmental laws, state environmental laws, and their implementing regulations, there's a lot of terms that have been defined by Congress and EPA that have special meanings with respect to that environmental law. RCRA has a whole glossary of terms. If you look in 40 CFR Part 260.10, you will see a number of terms that are specifically defined by EPA for the purposes of the regulations. And with respect to the hazardous waste determination process that we're going to talk about here more in a few seconds, you'll hear us refer to a number of terms and things like spent material, sludge, byproduct, commercial chemical product, scrap metal. There's three different definitions of scrap metal. These all have very specific meanings under RCRA. And so your common sense or what you think the Webster definition of a particular material is, be aware that that may not fit with how the implementing regulations have defined it. So just be aware that there are a number of terms that are used within the implementing regulations that have very specific meanings and that are used in the waste determination process under RCRA. Okay, let's go to the next slide, major regulations used to identify hazardous wastes. And this goes back to the four basic the regulatory framework outlines the process of determining whether something's a hazardous waste or not. You've answered your three questions. I know what it is, I know how it was produced, and I have a pretty good idea what I'm going to do with it. The way you go about determining whether it's a hazardous waste under RCRA is you first see if that material has been specifically excluded from the definition of solid waste. If it's not defined as a solid waste, it cannot be defined as a hazardous waste. So hazardous wastes are a subset of solid waste. We'll look at that more in just a few seconds. If Congress or EPA hasn't excluded that material from the definition of solid waste, then you have to determine if it meets the regulatory definition of a solid waste. We'll explain how that occurs. If we define our material based on what it is, how it was produced, and what I'm doing with it as a solid waste, then the next step is to determine whether Congress or EPA has provided that solid waste an exclusion from the definition of hazardous waste. Those of you who might be doing cleanups or response actions at mining sites or mineral processing sites, smelters and whatnot, there is something called Bevel Amendment. I can't really go into a lot of detail on it. You can have a whole course on that by itself. But it excludes a number of solid waste streams from mining and mineral processing operations that are pretty nasty in some cases, but they're not defined as hazardous wastes. They've been excluded by Congress. EPA has done a study on it and have clarified that exclusion. And so you need to be aware of that. While solid waste, they may be subject to some state regulatory standards or special waste standards, but they're excluded from the definition of hazardous waste. The final step or fourth step would be, if I have a solid waste which has not been excluded, then I determine whether it meets the definition of a hazardous waste. And that's where we get into determining whether it has been listed by EPA, or if it, the waste, solid waste has not been listed by EPA, whether it exhibits one of four characteristics or any of the characteristics of hazardous waste. Final thing, point there is variances in rulemaking petitions. This just provides the regulated community or industry, if you will, the opportunity to petition EPA or the state to where something has been defined as a solid waste or a hazardous waste, to have a site-specific or sometimes even a nationwide decision made where something that had been defined as a hazardous waste, they can petition to seek it being declassified as a hazardous waste. This is rarely used in the Superfund world. You'll hear it referred to as delisting. It occasionally has been done at where there's been a large volume of waste, where delisting made sense from a management standpoint, as well as just the nature of the waste stream that they were dealing with. Yeah, let's go to the next slide. So let's begin with our first, just a brief discussion on what types of materials are excluded from the definition of solid waste. The original RCRA contained Congress had identified certain materials, and the implementing regulations that EPA has established have excluded certain materials from regulation under RCRA by not defining them as solid waste. Where you would find these in the regulations are in 40 CFR 261.4A is an apple. And this would include things such as domestic sewage that's flowing through pipes to a publicly owned treatment works, for example. Or source special nuclear and byproduct material, as the Department of Energy defines those radioactive materials. So these are some examples of a couple of materials that have been excluded from the definition of solid waste. Again, the point being that if something's been excluded from the definition of solid waste, it cannot be defined as a hazardous waste. The next slide is where we'll talk briefly about the regulatory definition of solid waste. And you know, you can't, the best way I could say this is probably one of the most confusing parts of the implementing regulations under RCRA. Especially if you have something that's going to be recycled, this is where the definition of solid waste can become very complex and confusing. If you're simply going to send something off-site for disposal, and by disposal I mean you're going to have it landfilled, you're going to have it incinerated, then the definition of solid waste is pretty straightforward. But if you're going to have your material, if you're considering recycling it in some manner or having it reclaimed for a mineral value or some other, an energy value, okay, that it may possess, then RCRA's definition of solid waste can be more confusing and certainly can be complicated in some situations on that. The way the definition of the regulatory definition of solid waste is set forth in 40 CFR 261.2 is the rules define solid waste as discarded materials. The regulations then define what we mean by discarded. And discarded is defined as a material that is abandoned. That's probably the simplest one. And by abandoned, we mean you're going to landfill it. Okay, you're going to incinerate it. Okay, and or you're storing it with the intent to dispose of it by landfilling or incinerating. So, a material can be defined as being discarded and therefore a solid waste by meeting this definition of abandoned. The second way materials can meet the definition of solid waste is if they're recycled in certain ways. And we just don't have enough time to go through this, but I'll try to give you a summary of it, of how it works. This has been a vexing issue under RCRA since the implementing regulations came out in 1980. In 1985, EPA made a major effort to redefine what materials would be subject to RCRA regulations, defined as solid waste when recycled and not. And they've also worked on that, at a major rulemaking that came out a few years ago, and they're still continuing to work on this, refine this definition of solid waste as it applies to materials that are recycled. But essentially, there are if a material is going to be burned and it's not a normal fuel, okay, then that material is still going to meet a solid waste when disposed of it. Okay. If you have a material that is spent, what we define as a spent material, that's where it's been used, and through its use can no longer be used for its intended purpose, and therefore it has to be reclaimed. Classic example would be like a solvent, where solvent's been used to degrease something over time. It becomes sufficiently contaminated that it can no longer be used for its intended purpose, and so it has to be redistilled. This would be something we would define, the solvent, that is, a spent material that would need to be reclaimed. Currently, the regulations define that as a solid waste. Once it's been redistilled, the new distilled solvent's considered a product that's being used. But again, until that reclamation occurs, the spent material is defined as a solid waste, and if hazardous, a hazardous waste, and is regulated as such. There are also a couple of waste streams that are associated. They're unique to the pesticide manufacturing industry that the agency has defined as inherently waste-like. There's about eight of them. They're specific to pesticide manufacturers, and the agency made a determination back in 1985 that regardless of how you potentially would recycle them, they're always going to consider them solid waste. And then the final one deals with military munitions. This came out in 1997. This deals with munitions that has been taken out of the active arsenal and are going to be disposed of. In some cases, it could also apply to unexploded ordnance that is found off range, not on an active military range. Okay. Where, again, it would meet the definition of a solid waste for purposes of RCRA. So that's kind of a quick summary of the various ways that the agency defines discarded materials for purposes of defining whether that material meets the regulatory definition of solid waste under RCRA. Moving along, the next section deals with exclusions from the definition of hazardous waste. So at this point, you've made a determination with the materials, the waste streams that you've generated during your response action, that they meet the regulatory definition of solid waste. For example, your intent is to dispose of them off-site at a landfill. See, it's discarded material by virtue of you abandoning the material. Question would be, is it excluded from the federal definition of hazardous waste? And again, Congress, in the RCRA statute, provided a number of different exclusions for certain solid waste from the definition of hazardous waste. These included waste from the mining, mineral processing industry, from oil and natural gas exploration activities. Another one, which some of you probably are familiar or might be following, is combustion fossil fuel, waste from the combustion of fossil fuel, coal ash, fly ash, bottom ash. That's one that there's currently some regulatory work going on to define whether or not they're going to regulate it as a hazardous waste or solid waste, special waste. So there are a number of solid wastes. They're found in the regulations in 40 CFR 261.4B that cover a large group of materials within the paragraphs of that part of the CFR that these waste streams have been excluded from the federal definition of hazardous waste. The best I can say about that is if you have a specific situation where you run into that, bear in mind that if you look at those regulations, there might be a paragraph that the CFR has that describes the scope of that exclusion, but there's probably, 100 pages of Federal Register preamble or interpretive memos or even guidance documents that the agency has issued which clarify the scope of that exclusion. The important thing is just to understand that there are a large number of solid waste streams that have been excluded from the definition of hazardous waste by Congress and EPA's implementing regulations, and they're found there in 261.4B. And depending on the nature of your site, these obviously might be relevant, and you should consider that. The only caution I will say to you, though, is again, if they are excluded from the federal definition of hazardous waste, the state you're working in may be more stringent. For example, going back to California, waste streams that are excluded from the federal definition of hazardous waste may still be regulated in the state of California as a California hazardous waste under their implementing regulations. So just be aware of that. This is a case where the states can be more stringent. Okay, moving to the next slide, we finally arrive at our definition of hazardous waste. So you've had this material, you know what it is, you know how it was produced, and you know what you're doing with it. You've determined that it's not excluded from the definition of solid waste, that it meets the regulatory definition of solid waste, that it has not been excluded from the definition of hazardous waste. So how do you determine whether it's a hazardous waste now? There are two ways that Congress gave authority to EPA to define hazardous waste. The first one is EPA could go out and specifically through a rulemaking study the waste stream and list it as a hazardous waste. And this is what we refer to as a listed hazardous waste. The other mechanism the agency has for defining hazardous waste is to define a property or what we call a characteristic. So if they've chosen not to list a specific waste stream as hazardous waste, they can define a characteristic or property. And if a waste that hasn't been excluded, okay, solid waste that hasn't otherwise been excluded, exhibits any of these properties or characteristics, then it's required to be managed as a hazardous waste. There are also two ancillary rules that apply which deal with mixtures of solid wastes and listed hazardous wastes. And you might have heard of this. This is referred to as the mixture rule. The short story is simply is if you mix a listed hazardous waste and a non-hazardous waste, the mixture is considered a listed hazardous waste unless you petition the regulatory agency and prove otherwise. You'll have to manage that mixture as a hazardous waste. There's a corresponding rule called the derived from rule, and that's where a waste has been derived from the treatment, storage, or disposal of another hazardous waste, or listed, in this case, a listed hazardous waste. So if you treat a listed hazardous waste and you generate a residual from the treatment of that listed hazardous waste, the assumption is that residual is also going to be considered a listed hazardous waste and required to be managed as a hazardous waste, again, unless you petition otherwise to have it delisted. So that's the derived from rule. Now let's go to the next slide. And this just goes back to the different types of listed hazardous waste identified by EPA. There are three categories of listed hazardous waste. Waste from non-specific sources. These are the ones that are given the F codes. So F001, through F039. And these are simply the classic one we usually talk about are spent solvents. Those are defined in F001 through F005 that contain certain solvents such as some chlorinated solvents or halogenated solvents, some solvents that always exhibit the characteristic of ignitability, such as acetone, other solvents such as benzene. Okay, and the idea here is it doesn't matter who produces it. It can be an auto body shop or it could be a chemical manufacturer. If the waste stream meets the description on the listing that EPA has provided for it, then that waste is considered a hazardous waste. You do not have to test. It's almost an administrative thing, if you will. That's where we go back to how was it produced. Know what it is, and we know how it was produced. We look at what EPA has defined in their listings, a different list of hazardous waste. If it meets that description, it's considered a hazardous waste. We don't have to test for it anymore. We identify it, and we assign it the waste code that EPA has provided for it. The other list of waste are, besides the F codes, or non-specific sources, or waste from specific sources. These are given, the prefix is given as K, so, K001 through like K100 and something. These are unique to specific industrial operations. So again, your response action would have to be addressing either a cleanup at one of these industries, or obviously a disposal facility where they have managed waste from these industries. So you have to have a pretty good idea of how this stuff was produced in order to define it as a K waste. Okay, because these include things such as distillation bottoms from chlorobenzene manufacturing. So really very specific descriptions on how the waste stream was produced. The third category of listed hazardous waste are discarded commercial chemical products. These are denoted by either a P, as in Peter, or a U code. And these really apply to two types of waste streams. This would be where you have a drum of a virgin chemical product that meets the definition or technical grade of the chemical that EPA has identified. For example, benzene. I have a drum, a 55-gallon drum of benzene solvent. And that's what it is. It's not a mixture. It's pure benzene, and I'm going to throw it away. That would be a U waste. Okay? The difference between the U and the P's are this, is that P identify under RIC what we call acutely hazardous waste. These are typically things that are pesticides or certain types of waste streams that in very small amounts pose significant risk, and so they're subject to regulation at a much smaller level. And it's actually, they're subject to regulation if you generate 2.2 pounds of that particular acute hazardous waste in a calendar month versus normally you have 1,000. Or 100 kilograms, if you were an active industrial facility, to be subject to regulation for managing a non-acute hazardous waste. But again, when we refer to these commercial chemical products, they're defined as listed hazardous waste if they meet the technical description, or in a case where there are a mixture of different chemicals, okay, in the drum of unused material that you're discarding, that one of those chemicals is the sole active ingredient, such as in the case of maybe a pesticide, where there might be inert products and carriers, but, Aldrin or some other pesticide is the sole active ingredient in that mixture. The only other place you might encounter the P and U waste streams in the response world is that somebody had a tank. Say somebody had a tank, underground storage tank of trichloroethylene. Okay, and it leaked. This is unused trichloroethylene and it leaked. And the soil became contaminated and you had to clean that soil up, or you had to clean up Okay, again, the materials that have been contaminated through the release of this. Okay, in that case, there's a provision in 261.33, D as in David, you'll see that there's a little comment there, and it refers to spill or debris or cleanup material resulting from, again, a release of that commercial chemical product, unused commercial chemical product. Then the cleanup materials that you generate there are assigned that U or P code. Okay? So that's usually where we encounter the P and U codes in the cleanup world, is where there's been a release of a product, okay, a pure product that meets those descriptions. And again, you're dealing with the debris or the soil that you've had to clean up as a result of that release. And we would identify it as a listed hazardous waste that way. The next slide, again, I just want to talk, I mentioned, alluded earlier about some of the differences between listed and characteristic hazardous waste. Listed, you do not test to determine whether something's a listed waste. Again, based on your knowledge of the process that produced the waste, you look to see if that description matches what EPA has provided in its discussion, specific listing of that waste stream that matches. There it is. It's defined as a hazardous waste. No testing is required. Characteristic wastes, reactivity doesn't really have a test per se, but they all have an associated test which can be used to determine whether the waste stream exhibits the characteristic. Talk more about that in the next slide. But that's a fundamental difference between listed and characteristic waste. At CERCLA sites, as you all know, a lot of times you don't know how these waste streams were produced, especially, say, if you come upon a disposal facility that didn't have good records or whatever, they have a bunch of drums there and containing waste streams, and you don't know how those wastes were produced. In the amendments to the National Contingency Plan back in the early 1990s, EPA provided some policy or guidance to help during the Superfund response actions and answering that question. Basically, what it said is if you don't know how it was produced, you do not have to assume that TCE in that drum is a listed hazardous waste. Okay? And because a lot of times you won't know. So you're given some flexibility in terms of not assuming that something meets a listing, provided you don't have any definitive information that would otherwise define that waste as a listed hazardous waste. So that's an important consideration during cleanups to be aware of. Okay. We'll move on to the next slide and kind of briefly go through some of the characteristics of hazardous waste here. As I mentioned earlier, if your waste stream does not meet the definition of a listed hazardous waste, then you determine if it's a hazardous waste by whether it exhibits any of these four characteristics. Ignitability is defined in regulations in 261.21. The other characteristics are corrosivity, reactivity, and toxicity. In ignitability, the agency defines several different ways a hazardous waste will exhibit the characteristic of ignitability. The most common one is the use of a flash point test, where if the waste stream is volatile and the vapors existing over the liquid will flash at a temperature of 120 degrees or more, or less, I should say, then it will exhibit the characteristic of ignitability. The characteristic of corrosivity is defined several different ways. If it's aqueous, that means you can get a pH reading out of it using a pH meter. Then if the pH is greater than or equal to 12.5 or less than or equal to 2, so it's on either side of the spectrum there, it's defined as being a corrosive hazardous waste. The third characteristic reactivity is the most subjective of the definitions, characteristics, in that there isn't really a specific test that's used for determining whether stuff is waste streams will exhibit the reactive characteristic. Rather, it's based on really the generator's knowledge. If it, something requires special handling, because if it's exposed to air or water, it can violently erupt or explode, or if it generates hydrogen sulfide or hydrogen cyanide gas when, again, exposed to acidic environments or another environment, which would cause, you know, harm to human health or the environment, if proximate to the waste stream, then it's defined as reactive. Also, military munitions, because they can go boom, typically defined as reactive waste, if they meet the definition of solid waste under the military munitions rule. The final characteristic, which is one of the more common ones that you'll encounter in the response world, is the toxicity characteristic. And that really simply evaluates waste for the presence of about 39 different chemicals, 8 metals, and the others are organics, synthetic organics, and you're looking to determine the whether or not those constituents will leach from the waste stream at levels where they could impair drinking water and therefore require them to be managed as hazardous wastes instead of solid wastes. And this toxicity characteristic is defined by the toxicity characteristic leaching procedure, or TCLP test, which I'm sure some of you are aware of. And again, it determines the risk that that waste poses to contaminating groundwater supplies and requiring that it be managed in a hazardous waste landfill instead of a municipal solid waste landfill. So those are the four characteristics of hazardous waste. Okay, going to the next slide, I talked a little bit about the mixture and derived from rule. Again, there is a substantial legal history behind these two rulemakings, particularly the mixture rule. Again, just to suffice it, with the mixture rule, you mix a listed hazardous waste with a solid waste or non-hazardous waste, then the resulting mixture is going to be identified as a hazardous waste. The derived from rule is where you have a listed waste, and you, as a result of treating, storing, or disposing it, you generate a residual from it or a derived from waste. That derived from waste is, again, assumed to be hazardous. Okay, and then our final item here with respect to determining whether something is a hazardous waste or requires management of hazardous waste is the Containian policy. Containian policy, you will not find it in the federal regulations. That's why it's a policy, right? But with the implementation of Superfund and RCRA corrective action authorities in the 1980s, and a large amount of environmental media that had been contaminated through releases, the question became, how do we determine whether contaminated soil, contaminated sediments, contaminated groundwater, how do we determine or whether it should be managed as RCRA hazardous waste or not? And this resulted in EPA headquarters creating the Containian policy. And it's been, if you have access to our notes, there's a number of federal registers that discuss the Containian policy. It actually withstood a legal challenge. So it's in effect. It's considered an ARAR for purposes of CERCLA. And what it requires is contaminated environmental media, such as contaminated soils, to be managed as hazardous waste if it's determined to contain a listed hazardous waste, or if it obviously exhibits a characteristic of hazardous waste. This occurs on a case-by-case basis. A number of the states have actually come out with definitive guidance or regulations to help implement the Containian policy within the state, and so you should be aware of that. For example, Michigan provides regulations on how you determine the Containian, whether environmental media contains a listed waste. The question is, as often occurs, is if you make it contained in policy, then after you treat it, how do you determine whether it no longer contains a listed hazardous waste? That's often referred to as a contained out policy. And again, you look to that guidance and regulations. Oftentimes the states will provide it. They'll provide specific numbers which have been established based on risk-based scenarios, and that can be used to make a contained out determination as well. The final thing on the next slide is variances and petitions. Again, I referred to that earlier. These are just situations where waste streams that you've generated during a response action are defined as hazardous waste, they require management as hazardous waste. You do have options if it's appropriate to attempt to have it removed, from the definition of hazardous waste. If it's a listed hazardous waste, there's the process of delisting that occurs, goes through the region, and then there's the contain out determination, which applies to environmental media that has been contaminated through a release with listed hazardous wastes. Again, it's an opportunity, maybe after treatment, to make a determination that sediments no longer contain a listed hazardous waste, and again, therefore can be managed as non-hazardous wastes. The final thing we'll mention here with respect to the regulatory program for hazardous waste are universal wastes. Some of you may have heard of these before. Universal waste is an alternative regulatory program. Federally, it's established in 40 CFR Part 273, and it deals with currently four major categories of waste streams: batteries, rechargeable batteries like NiCads, certain types of pesticides that have been recalled, mercury-containing equipment such as thermometers, pressure gauges, other types of electrical equipment that might have mercury present in it, and then fluorescent lamps. Where you have these intact items, you can choose to manage them as universal wastes instead of regular hazardous waste. It provides some flexibility and some less stringent management requirements with respect to accumulating it and sending it off-site for disposal. Management. Be aware some states also provide additional definitions or items that are considered universal waste within those states. Could be aerosol cans, could be certain types of electrical equipment, and some paint wastes in some states. I believe Texas are defined as universal waste within their state regulatory program. So it just provides an alternative regulatory program with more flexibility than the standard RCRA definition of hazardous waste and the corresponding RCRA hazardous waste management requirements. Okay, Gene, I don't know if this is time for a break or questions.
We actually do have a number of questions that came in, and okay. If you wouldn't mind, we can go ahead and start taking some of them.
Sure.
Okay, our first question comes in from Arlington, Virginia, and this is actually a pretty open one, but they commented that it's been nearly 35 years since RCRA has been posted, and they want to know if it's been updated and if there are any plans to do so.
Now, I'm not aware of that. I know, I'm assuming the question is congressional action, legislative.
Yeah, this one came in after you had talked that it had been put out in 1976.
There could be a couple of bills that are kicking around there, whether they have much traction in the present Congress. I'm not aware of. Fortunately, I can't answer that for you. I haven't heard of any, major effort to amend RCRA in this current Congress. Maybe some of the other people out there might know.
Yeah,
we have some folks from headquarters.
If anybody else is listening, you're certainly welcome to type up any information you might have if RCRA is being looked at or explored with an update. You can use the question submission form, and I'll be happy to read out your responses
sure.
if we get any of those. Our next participant asks, You had mentioned that it was very possible for something to not federally be defined as a waste, but that it might fall under a state regulatory statute that it was a waste. So per slide number 9, is there some list or online reference tables so that you can easily tell which states have more stringent regulations?
No, I don't know. The Association of State and Territorial, I apologize, I can't remember exactly how the organization, but I know that they do provide a listing of the various different state programs, and there's been an attempt, I think through their website, if I recall, where they've tried to identify areas where the state programs have differed from the federal. And so that might be a resource. I mean, a more complicated way about it was EPA does update, has a website on state authorization and the status of state programs under RCRA and whether they've adopted and been authorized for certain rules. But I don't think that goes into whether the state has been more stringent, has rules more stringent than that. So, unfortunately, I don't know of a reference off the top of my head where you could easily define that. I can say that most states are pretty consistent with the federal government. California is the major exception. Now, there are a few other states, such as Utah and Maryland, that have specific rules for chemical munitions, and that's because they have operations that involve the disposal of chemical munitions or management of chemical munitions in their states. So most states are pretty much lockstep with the federal program, don't differ too much. California is the big anomaly out there.
Okay, great. The next question, I think you may have addressed it, but this participant would like to know if solid waste includes liquids and sludges. And
yeah,
they also go on to ask about contaminated sediments.
Yeah, no, that's a class question. The definition of solid waste includes, it could be wastewater. It can include compressed gas or cylinders of compressed gas that are full that you're disposing of. The term solid waste is a legal term. It doesn't mean that the waste stream has to be physically solid.
Okay, great.
It's just the idea that something's being abandoned or thrown away, and I think the term originated from the 1940s, the legal term. But they define anything that you're getting rid of or throwing away as solid waste. So a wastewater that's produced by an industrial operation that's put into an impoundment or a tank before it's discharged, maybe it's treated and then discharged and it's, you know, into a river. Prior to its discharge into that river, that wastewater that's being collected and treated would meet the definition of solid waste under RCRA.
Okay. Okay. We have a participant from Alabama who would like to know, how can a non-promulgated policy, for example, the, quote, contained-in policy, be considered an ARAR for CERCLA responses?
Originally it was whether or not it was legal to apply the contained-in rule at all or contained-in policy as whole. There was a court case on that. I don't remember the exact name of it, but where it was challenged and it was upheld. And there's actually EPA documents or guidance that mention the contained-in policy and identify it as an ARAR specifically for CERCLA response actions. In addition, be aware is that some states have actually promulgated rules or regulations under their state programs to define the contained-in policy, if you will. So they actually have implementing rules for that. So that can be also considered part of the state ARARs as well, not just the federal ARAR. As I mentioned, a number of states have developed regulations to explain contained in and contained out determinations with respect to whether or not contaminated environmental media has to be managed as a hazardous waste. And so by virtue of the fact that there are promulgated state regulations, they can be identified as an ARAR in that case. But if the commenter, you have my email, if you would like me to provide you with the Federal Register reference or whatever, you can send me an email to my address, and I'd be happy to find that for you and give that to you.
Okay. Let's just take two more questions while we can, and then we'll go ahead and resume with the presentation. So our next question comes in, again, also from Arlington, Virginia, and this participant would like to know, did the presented state that excluded materials can, quote, be included as hazardous waste if they meet characteristic waste designation?
Okay. No, if something has been excluded from the definition of hazardous waste, even though it exhibits a characteristic, it cannot, you know, it would not be brought back in or regulated as a hazardous waste. So the exclusion trumps the fact that the waste stream would exhibit the characteristic.
Okay, great. Great. And our last question before we resume is going to come in from Albany, New York. And this participant would like to know, how would we determine whether spent activated carbon used in an FVE system to treat PCE is hazardous waste? The carbon will be regenerated.
Okay, well, the question would be, okay, how did you define the PCE that was going into the FVE unit? Okay, was that defined as a listed hazardous waste prior to treatment? Because the activated carbon unit would be an example of a derived from waste from the treatment in your pollution control system of treating, say, contaminated soil that had PCE. So I don't know. You would have to first determine how you're managing defining that PCE that's in the soil prior to being treated by the SVE unit. That would, if you determine that that's hazardous waste by virtue of only exhibiting a characteristic, say the toxicity characteristic, then the spent activated carbon canister with it would only be considered hazardous waste if it also exhibits that characteristic.
Okay. Great. Let's go ahead and resume with the technical portion of the broadcast, and I just wanted to do a quick time check that I have us set at 2:12 p.m. Eastern.
Okay. Thanks for the questions. Those were very good questions. I'm sure some of you might have a lot more there. Waste identification will generate a lot of questions under RCRA. Let's go ahead and now move to the land disposal restrictions and try to give you a brief overview of these requirements and how they apply during response actions. Okay. In the next slide is entitled Land Disposal Restriction Basics. And this is a brief overview of what the LDRs are, the Land Disposal Restrictions Program or regulatory requirements were established under authority of the Hazardous and Solid Waste Amendments to RCRA in 1984. And the basis for them was congressional concern with untreated hazardous waste being placed in land disposal units. The concern was that untreated waste in land disposal units posed a long-term risk to human health and the environment, and essentially the LDR program puts in place a pretreatment program, if you will, which in order to ensure safer land disposal, hazardous wastes need to be treated to meet a treatment standard established by best demonstrated available technology before they can legally be land disposed. Now, land disposal for purposes of the LDR program or land disposal restrictions program is a broad term. It just doesn't mean landfill. It means basically when you're going to place something on the ground, okay, or dispose of it. So, for example, if you had a waste stream that you were going to dispose of in an abandoned missile silo out in Nebraska, and there are some missile silos that are actually being used as waste disposal units out there, that would be considered land disposal for purposes of this program. And so waste streams that would go into that type of unit, okay, even though it's not what we would consider a classic landfill, okay, would require that the waste meet these treatment standards before it's no longer prohibited from land disposal or for placement in that missile silo. Waste piles, surface impoundments, these are all considered land disposal for purposes of land disposal restrictions program. The other important concept here is this idea that the restrictions attach to the hazardous waste at the point of generation. What that simply means is, okay, there are a number of different examples to illustrate this, but I'll try to give you a simple one. You're doing a response action. Say you're doing a cleanup of a plating shop. We have some OSCs out there who are doing removal actions. You have the plating. You have a vat of a spent cyanide solution that was used in this plating line that you have to dispose of. You determine that the spent cyanide solution, as it's sitting in there, is a listed hazardous waste, F007. You then go collect it, put it in a drum, and get ready to send it off-site. The LDR is attached to the point where you actively generate and manage that. By cleaning it up, you've now made a determination that you're going to dispose of this stuff. You've generated it. So the point of generation has occurred. You need to determine whether that spent cyanide solution is prohibited from being disposed in landfill because it needs to be treated to meet these treatment standards. And so that's the idea behind these land disposal restrictions attached to the hazardous waste point of generation. So they go hand in hand with waste determination. You make a determination that something's a hazardous waste. As soon as you define it as a hazardous waste, you have to determine the applicability of these LDR treatment standards, and that's going to dictate whether that waste is prohibited from being placed in a land disposal unit as is, or if it's going to require treatment prior to it being placed in a land disposal unit. And obviously, if it requires treatment, that's an additional cost that you're going to have to be aware of or consider during your response action. Going to the next slide, the major regulations for land disposal restriction requirements are found in 40 CFR Part 268. These, again, are the federal regulations, but states will often incorporate these by reference, or they may have their own section of their code where they've established these. But the primary regulations we're looking at is how do you determine whether a waste is subject to the land disposal restrictions program, and this is the concept of determining whether the waste is restricted, i.e., it's subject to the land ban. If it's prohibited, if it's what we call a prohibited hazardous waste, that means it does not meet treatment standards and is prohibited from land disposal. If it's not prohibited, then it's a waste that either based on how it was generated or the fact that it's been treated, it meets the applicable treatment standards, and there's no prohibition on placing it in a land disposal unit. The other major regulations implementing this program are obviously the regulations that help you determine what are the applicable treatment standards to your specific RCRA or hazardous waste. And we'll talk about that. That's where the bulk of this discussion is going to on land ban is going to be about. There also is a prohibition against dilution and long-term storage of RCRA or hazardous waste to avoid meeting the LDR treatment standards. Again, dilution is not the solution. As we will explain in a few seconds, the treatment standards that have been established for RCRA hazardous waste in many cases are based on a concentration of a regulated constituent such as TCE or benzene or lead in the treated waste. And the statute and the implementing regulations establish a prohibition against attempting to dilute the waste to meet that treatment standard. So your means of treating the waste to achieve the treatment standard can't simply be considered dilution. There's also a requirement, and this is, you know, applicable to active generating facilities more than in a cleanup or response action, but Congress provided authority or provided a provision in the implementing regulations specify that you simply can't store waste that are subject to LDR treatment standards for like a year or more and as a means of avoiding having to comply with the requirement that they be treated before they're ultimately disposed of. Relevant to your cleanup operations is if you send hazardous waste off-site for treatment and disposal, and they are subject to the LDR's restrictions program, you'll have some additional tracking and record-keeping requirements. These have been simplified over the past 10 years. They're not nearly as onerous or as involved as they were back in the 1990s and early 2000s. But just bear in mind that when you send hazardous waste off-site that are subject to the land disposal restrictions, in addition to the manifest, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, that has to accompany the waste during transportation, when you send the waste to your disposal facility or your treatment facility, you'll have to provide a notice to them and a certification as to whether the waste stream meets the treatment standards or does not meet the treatment standards. This informs them, if they receive the waste, as to whether or not they can land dispose it as is, or whether it's obviously based on how they're going to manage it or if they're going to send it to another facility, that this waste stream is prohibited from land disposal. And this notice requirement is required just with the initial shipment of the waste to that facility. You don't have to do the tracking or the notice and certification requirements with every additional shipment, provided that the waste and the receiving facility doesn't change. In addition, there are some variances from the LDR treatment standards, and again, these are for unique situations where you can achieve a different treatment standard than the one that EPA has established based on the unique nature of your waste stream, or you can petition for a variance altogether with meeting the treatment standards based on the risk that that particular waste poses with respect to disposal. These variances have been used on occasion in Superfund responses, both in the remedial side and even some removal actions. Where they've had large volumes of these waste streams, and met the criteria, they've sought a variance from the treatment standards. We won't have enough time to go into the details of how that variance is granted and obtained. I'll briefly talk about it in a few minutes, but it's something that is available and that is used on occasion in the cleanup world. Okay, the next slide is entitled Identification of Restricted Waste. The bottom line here is that any RCRA hazardous waste that's been identified by EPA is subject to the Land Disposal Restriction Program. Congress initially had provided some ability for EPA to delay the effective date of LDR regulations based on the lack of available treatment disposal capacity for the waste streams in question. These variances and extended or delayed effective dates have long since passed, so if you generate a RCRA hazardous waste, something that's defined as a RCRA hazardous waste, you can assume that it is subject to the Land Disposal Restrictions Program. And the salient issue or the important question you have to answer is, does it meet the applicable treatment standards or does it not meet the treatment standards and therefore is prohibited from land disposal? So that's really the critical issue here. Moving to the next slide, let's talk about what these treatment standards are, how they're expressed, and how you determine the appropriate or applicable treatment standard to the RCRA hazardous waste that you have. It's the responsibility of you as the generator during the response action when you create waste as part of your cleanup, okay, or you're managing waste and disposing it, you're going to be considered the generator under RCRA. So not only must you determine whether it's a hazardous waste, but if it's a hazardous waste, you must determine whether the waste is what treatment standards under the LDR program apply to it and whether the waste stream requires treatment or is prohibited from land disposal, and then provide that information to subsequent handlers, say if you're sending it off-site. So this is an obligation of the generator to make this determination. One thing I should have mentioned at the beginning of this, remember this, though. If it's not a hazardous waste, the land disposal restrictions do not apply. Okay, so you have to have identified your waste as hazardous in order for these LDR regulations that I'm talking about now to apply. The treatment standard, Congress provided a one-paragraph description in the law as to what a treatment standard is, and that's just broadly identified as any means besides dilution, okay, which will reduce the volume or reduce the toxicity of the waste and make it safer for disposal, land disposal, such that it doesn't pose a long-term risk to human health and the environment. EPA used best demonstrated available technology, the performance of best demonstrated available technologies, as a means of establishing a treatment standard for a RCRA hazardous waste. In short, what they did is they would look at, for example, a waste stream such as F001, listed hazardous waste, which is halogenated solvents used in degreasing. And they would determine, they look at the technologies that were applicable to treating a contaminated spent solvent. And generally, the two types of technologies, what you'll find with most hazardous waste streams is it will, they define first what they call a treatability group, something called a wastewater or a non-wastewater. Non-wastewater is defined as something that basically has less than 1% water in it. Okay, or I should say vice versa. Wastewater is defined as 99% water, 1% total organic carbon or other constituents in it. A non-wastewater is anything other than that. Once you've defined the waste treatability group, then you identify what the best demonstrated available technology is. And for non-wastewaters, typically the best demonstrated available technology is a combustion technology, such as incineration or a boiler industrial furnace, which is used to treat the waste. Based on that technology, EPA will establish, in most cases, a concentration of a regulated constituent in the treatment residual, and that will be what your treatment standard is. Again, it's going to be based on the physical form of the waste. Is it a wastewater or a non-wastewater? For example, if you had a wastewater, which was defined as FO1, the treatment standard would be based on the performance of stripping, air stripping, or maybe another type of conventional wastewater treatment technology. And so you would have a different concentration of that constituent in the treated waste. You'd have a different standard based on its physical form. So it's important for you to understand when you're trying to determine treatment standards, you need to define what the physical form or what treatability group your hazardous waste fits into. Wastewater or non-wastewater, because that's going to help you determine what the applicable treatment standards are, because the treatment standards will differ because the treatment standards are based on the performance of technologies, and the technologies for a wastewater versus a non-wastewater differ. In some cases, the agency has also established the treatment technology based on a required technology. Now, they've expressed it as a concentration, which was the previous case I was talking about. You could avail yourself to any technologies, provided they're not dilution, to achieve that treatment standard. But you will sometimes, if you look in the regulations, you will see the treatment standard listed as an acronym or an abbreviation. And in this case, this will be a specific technology which is required to be used to achieve the treatment standard. So be aware of that. As I mentioned earlier, treatability groups refers to whether your hazardous waste fits into either a wastewater or non-wastewater category. There are also, within the treatability groups, there are what we call treatment subcategories. These are just subdivisions, usually for non-wastewaters, based on the concentration of a regulated constituent, for example, mercury. Mercury is D008 waste. It's characteristic hazardous waste with the D008 waste code. Depending on the level of mercury in your characteristic hazardous waste, if it's a non-wastewater. There may be different treatment subcategories that apply there based on the amount of mercury that's present in it. And this, again, will affect your treatment standard. So it's just another subdivision which might result in a different treatment standard for that particular waste stream you need to be aware of. All the treatment standards are set forth in 40 CFR 268 subpart D. Specifically, you'll find them in 268.40. If you turn to the next slide, you'll see the first bullet is universal treatment standards. When the agency went about identifying treatment standards for all the RCRA hazardous waste, they additionally, to give you an example, go back to our one of my favorite contaminants is benzene, okay, just because it's easy to illustrate it. Benzene can be identified as a RCRA hazardous waste in a number of different waste codes. It can be F005, a number of K-code waste streams have identified benzene as a regulated constituent. There's a U code for benzene, and benzene is also identified under the toxicity characteristic. So there are different waste codes which apply to hazardous waste that may have benzene in it. In the old days, years ago, 20 years ago, there was a different treatment standard for benzene in a non-wastewater form depending on which waste code it was assigned. This caused a lot of confusion and added a lot of complexity to identifying the LDR treatment standard based on the fact that benzene, you had to know what waste code it was in to identify the, you know, treatment standard. And the treatment standard for benzene in FO05 might be different than the treatment standard for benzene in U110 or whatever it is, or in D34 or D018. To solve that problem, the agency came up with something called universal treatment standards. And what they tried to establish is the same level of treatment for benzene, whether it's found in the waste codes identified as D018 or F005. So that's what we mean by the universal treatment standards. The universal treatment standards has another important point and a critical application which is complex, but you have to be aware of it when you go to identify LDR treatment standards. And that's where you're dealing with treatment standards for characteristic wastes only. Okay, so if you have a hazardous waste which is defined as hazardous by virtue of it exhibiting a characteristic, for example, let's say you have a lead waste, okay, a waste stream that exhibits a characteristic of toxicity for lead, you'll have to treat the lead in that waste to meet the applicable treatment standard. But the LDR treatment standard is also going to require you to treat for underlying hazardous constituents, which is the second bullet in that slide. And the question is, well, what's an underlying hazardous constituent? Okay, lead is the only metal that exhibits the characteristic of toxicity. So lead is what causes it, your waste stream to be defined as a hazardous waste. But let's assume you also have a bunch of other metals in it, like arsenic, cadmium, chromium, but they're not high enough. The concentrations aren't high enough to exhibit the toxicity characteristic. Well, the LDR treatment standard says, well, you have to meet the treatment standard for lead, but you also have to meet the treatment standard for any underlying hazardous constituent, such as arsenic, chromium, or cadmium, which you know is in there, that's above its universal treatment standard. And the universal treatment standard, the concentrations are much lower than the concentrations that are used to define whether or not something's a hazardous waste. So what that means is if you have a characteristic hazardous waste, you not only potentially have to treat for the constituent that causes it to exhibit the characteristic, you'll have to also potentially treat any of the underlying hazardous constituents that are above their universal treatment standards to meet the LDR, the treatment standard. So that's an important concept to remember if you're dealing only with characteristic hazardous waste and you're trying to determine the treatment standard. The third bullet there deals with alternative treatment standards. And this is simply where the agency has created, rather than oftentimes with like lab packs, hazardous debris and contaminated soils, these types of waste streams will have multiple waste codes that may apply to them. For example, lab packs are commonly used during like the cleanup of laboratories or schools, where you have numerous small containers of chemicals that are packed into a larger drum, and then disposed, the larger drum is simply disposed of as a lab pack. And it will contain all these numerous smaller chemicals which may have different hazardous waste codes for it. Rather than requiring you to identify each treatment standard for every different hazardous waste in the smaller containers, you can avail yourself to an alternative treatment standard which has been developed for the lab pack containing all those smaller containers. It just makes your life a little bit easier in terms of complying with these requirements. It's the same thing for hazardous debris. Hazardous debris is an example of that would be like a foundation of a building or concrete or say a flooring where there's been spills and contaminations. You're going to demolish the building. You have to get rid of the concrete or the floor or a secondary containment system for a tank where the tank has leaked and the concrete structure has been stained or has residuals of a listed hazardous waste in it. Rather than taking all that concrete and trying to send it off to an incinerator because that's the only way you can meet the treatment standard, you can avail yourself to an alternative treatment standard for hazardous debris, which would require you to, say, pressure wash or otherwise remove that superficial layer of contamination on the concrete, dispose of that as hazardous waste, and then the residual concrete that's been cleaned can be sent off as non-hazardous waste and go to a construction and debris landfill. So these alternative treatment standards are very relevant and important during the cleanup process. Unfortunately, I'm kind of running out of time. I can't really talk about like contaminated soils, but contaminated soils is another one. It's if you have contaminated soil, which is identified, again, as a RCRA hazardous waste because it contains a listed waste or it exhibits a characteristic, rather than meeting a treatment standard that was established for an industrial waste, the alternative treatment standard for contaminated soils affords you a more flexible, less stringent standard that can be easier to meet. As a result, and so it's commonly applied during cleanup processes, cleanup responses. Now, the next slide just kind of is some steps to help you determine the applicable treatment standard under the LDR program for the RCRA hazardous waste that you generate. It begins by properly identifying the applicable RCRA hazardous waste code, then you turn to 268.40, the table which lists or identifies all the treatment standards, and they're identified and assigned, the treatment standards are assigned to each different RCRA hazardous waste code. You look to determine what your treatability group is. Do you have a non-wastewater or a wastewater? Or if you have a non-wastewater, do you have a subcategory? Okay, based on, again, I mentioned the concentration of mercury as an example. For those waste streams that are defined as characteristic because of mercury. And you may also look to see if there's an alternative treatment standard as well. And that's how you would assign the treatment standard to your particular RCRA hazardous waste. So the critical thing here is it's in order to determine the applicable LDR treatment standard, you first must determine the RCRA hazardous waste code, which is what we talked about earlier in the waste identification. Once you have that, then you turn to the treatment standards in 40 CFR Part 268, and you determine what's the physical form of your waste, non-wastewater, wastewater, and you can find the concentration-based treatment standard for the specific constituents that are regulated in that waste stream. If you have a characteristic hazardous waste, what you'll see in your treatment standard is not only a treatment standard for the constituent that caused it to exhibit the characteristic, going back to our example of lead earlier, but you'll see a reference to 268.48. That's where they're referring you to also determining underlying hazardous constituents in that particular waste stream and ensuring that any underlying hazardous constituent that's present, okay, that concentration is above the universal treatment standard, that also must be met as well. So if arsenic was above the universal treatment standard, your waste stream, in that case, the lead and the arsenic would have to meet their respective treatment standards before the waste would be no longer prohibited from land disposal. Okay, I mentioned the next slide just goes into the discussion on alternative treatment standards for contaminated soil. Again, it avails you to more flexibility where you do not have to meet, say, the universal treatment standards for all the constituents, but what you can do is achieve the treatment standard by a 90% reduction of the maximum concentration of a hazardous constituent, which is capped by regulation at 10 times the UTF. So you can achieve either the treatment standard by reducing 90% the maximum concentration of the constituent or treating it to within 10 times its UTS. Again, this is often used during cleanup options because cleanup responses because, again, it provides more flexibility and a reduced stringency of the LDR treatment standard. If you flip to the next slide, again, that just goes on. It provides a little more details on alternative treatment standards for contaminated soil. Because I'm being pressed for time here, I'm going to skip that. If there's some questions on it, again, feel free to email me those. I'll be happy to try to answer that for you. The next slide just reiterates what I mentioned earlier when we opened the discussion about the land disposal restrictions requirements, that there is a dilution statutory and regulatory prohibition against diluting waste to meet the treatment standard, as well as storing the wastes in order to avoid meeting the treatment standards. And then finally, I'm not going to have time to go into too many details here, but again, if you do have LDR, if wastes and the LDR treatment standards are not going to be capable, you're not going to be able to meet them using the types of technologies that are available to you. And this happens in some of the cleanup operations, the cleanup responses. There are, say, an alternative treatment standard for contaminated soils. Again, won't work for your situation. You have the ability to seek a variance from a treatment standard, a legally applicable treatment standard, through these various different methods. The most common one is the treatment variance, treatability variance, I should say. The other two, like the no migration petition, that's rarely, if ever, been granted. And then you always also have the option, if it's a listed hazardous waste, of just trying to rather comply with the LDR treatment standard. Maybe you can attempt to delist it. If the waste is delisted, then the LDR treatment standards are no longer applicable to it. Okay, these next slides deal with treatability variance. Again, it becomes applicable where you can make a case that the waste is physically or chemically different from the waste stream that EPA evaluated in assigning or establishing a treatment standard for it. And again, during cleanup operations, this is a fairly easy case to make if you're dealing with, again, some sort of complex mixture of contaminated soil, contaminated materials, along with a listed waste stream. The next slide just provides some tips. It's just that the treatability variance used to have to go through EPA headquarters. It's been delegated to the EPA regional offices. In the CERCLA world, if you do obtain a variance, you do need to document that in your record of decision or your action memo if it's a removal action. And you generally will need a concurrence memorandum by the RCRA program. Not always, but it's generally required as well. Okay, Gene, I'm getting close on time here. It's about 2:45. If there are any questions on the LDR program, I'll be happy to take a couple right now before we conclude.
Certainly.
With some of the rules and policies to managing hazardous waste on-site and off-site.
Okay. We just had one question that came in that just really, again, was trying to highlight that you're specifically referencing contaminated soils, but does that new group include contaminated sludges and sediments as well?
Yeah, there's a definition of soil that EPA has established for purposes of that alternative treatment standard. And so it would distinguish from sludges or other types of remediation waste that you might generate. So be aware that there is this definition of what constitutes contaminated soil, and it's to distinguish it from, again, a sludge from a surface impoundment, say.
Okay. And just for our attendees, you can continue to submit your comments and questions. We will take more breaks or another break before we conclude today. So I encourage you to start typing up questions and comments as soon as they occur to you so we can get them in the queue and go through as many as we can in the time allotted.
Try to finish this next section off in 10 minutes. So we might have a chance for a few more questions. It's somewhat difficult to try to get through some major regulatory requirements in 2 hours, but we're trying our best here. I hope, you know, that you all are getting something out of this, and it's not too confusing. So if there are some follow-up questions, again, like, I'd be happy to attempt to address them for you. This final module is just a review of some common RCRA requirements for managing hazardous waste on-site and off-site. If you flip to the next slide, some of the typical RCRA requirements or policies that apply to on-site management hazardous waste in the CERCLA cleanup world, these would be the types of, again, equipment or units that you would use to manage RCRA hazardous wastes on-site. They include container standards, which is what would be applicable to your drums. Temporary units is typically used for tanks. Instead of having to meet the RCRA tank system requirements, which are fairly involved, temporary unit was a remediation unit created under the RCRA program back in the 1990s, which again afforded folks in the response world, the CERCLA world and the RCRA corrective action world, to operate and manage waste in a unit which didn't have to meet all the RCRA hazardous waste tank system standards, but would meet standards that were relevant to managing the remediation waste for the short duration that waste stream would be managed on site. There's also this policy dealing with the area of contamination. I'll briefly go over that. Corrective action management units. Again, this was created under the RCRA program to address the management of remediation wastes. And then there are some other requirements with respect that RCRA has established for reinjection of hazardous groundwater. Briefly, I'll kind of summarize that. If you're doing some sort of groundwater restoration program where you were extracting water from underground, treating it at the surface, and then reinjecting it, if that groundwater by chance was defined as a hazardous waste or contained a hazardous waste, when you reinjected it, if it didn't meet the LDR treatment standards, you would be prohibited from that. Realizing that was kind of a disincentive to a pump and treat or some sort of active restoration program for contaminated groundwater, Congress provided an amendment to RCRA and EPA provided guidance on clarifying that amendment that if you are doing groundwater restoration where you're reinjecting contaminated groundwater, you don't have to worry about meeting those LDR treatment standards before you reinject it. As long as that cleanup is authorized, that groundwater cleanup is being authorized under RCRA Corrective Action Authority or a CERCLA Response Authority. So that's the special policy that deals with reinjection of hazardous groundwater there. Another thing in the cleanup world where you might encounter RCRA requirements is if you're doing a cleanup at a facility that was regulated under RCRA, had to have a permit, and the unit, they had a, it could be anything from a container storage area to a landfill that was subject to RCRA closure and post-closure care requirements. These would be ARARs that you would have to address even if you're performing the cleanup, if you're performing the cleanup under CERCLA. Just bear in mind that what these are is they establish specific requirements under RCRA for closing hazardous waste management units, and if those units are closed with hazardous waste in place, i.e. a landfill, RCRA establishes post-closure care requirements as well. And these requirements are ARARs that you would have to address in your response action. Some of the off-site requirements that would apply are if you have containers that you are going to put on a truck or a railroad car, there are requirements, what we call pre-transport standards or requirements. And these really duplicate or refer to the Department of Transportation regulations for hazardous materials to ensure their safe transportation. So the pre-transport requirements would include proper containers, how the containers are labeled and marked and packaged, so they meet requirements established under the Department of Transportation for shipment off-site over public highways or railroads. In addition, RCRA establishes a manifest, which is a specific shipping document that is used to track hazardous waste from where they were generated to their ultimate disposal. In addition, if the site that you're doing the cleanup does not have an EPA identification number, in order to fulfill all of these RCRA record-keeping reporting using the manifest requirements, you'll need to have an EPA identification number assigned to you. And so as a generator, you'll apply, you fill out a form, 8700-12 is the form, and EPA of the state will assign you an ID number, and that will be used, again, for example, like using your manifest. It's required information on the manifest. I already referred to the LDR tracking requirements earlier. This was an additional requirement that notifies the subsequent handler as to whether the hazardous waste is prohibited from land disposal and requires treatment, or whether it can be placed in a land disposal unit without treatment. This is an additional information you provide when you're sending the waste off, shipping the waste off-site to a disposal or treatment facility or another handler. And then there's something called a biennial report. And folks say, well, I'm doing a cleanup action. What do I have to comply with a reporting requirement? The biennial report in some states actually require an annual report. So they're more stringent than the federal government in this case. Is if you are a large quantity generator, that means in your response action you generated more than 1,000 kilograms of hazardous waste in a calendar month. And you ship that off-site. Okay, that triggers a biennial or in some cases an annual reporting requirement, which is prepared in the following year, and it documents your hazardous waste activity of the previous year. And this is an ARAR. This is an ARAR at Superfund sites. So be aware that if you do generate large volumes of hazardous waste and ship it off-site, you trigger this biennial reporting requirement, which is basically the states handle this. They have different web-based systems or other approaches which allow you to prepare this information to track your hazardous waste activity, even if it's associated with a cleanup action, cleanup response. And so that's where this requirement comes from. Okay. I only have about another minute or two here, and I want to leave some time for questions, but the next slides just go into a little more details on the technical standards for containers. If you go to the next slide, temporary units. Again, temporary units are primarily used as an alternative standard for hazardous waste tank systems primarily, but also can be for containers. But there's a limit on how long these can be operated for. I think it's 1 or 2 years, and then it requires a renewal. The area contamination concept, this is an important concept, and what it does is it provides you some flexibility with respect to having to comply with LDR treatment standards. Fortunately, I don't really have a lot of time to talk about this, but the idea basically is if you're out of sight and you've had a release, for example, you have an abandoned landfill or a trench where somebody threw some drums and there's been a release resulting from that. If you can delineate the footprint of that area of where the release is, and I'm not talking about the plume, I'm talking about the soil contamination, okay, that is considered to be an area of contamination. And what EPA provided in a policy and guidance implementing the area of contamination is that you could move that contaminated soil within that AOC, area of contamination, within the boundaries of that, you could pick it up, put it back on the ground, assuming that it is defined as a hazardous waste, and you wouldn't trigger compliance with the LDR requirements, the treatment standards. Because remember, anytime you land dispose of a hazardous waste, which is effectively placing it on the ground, if the waste is prohibited from land disposal, you have to meet the treatment standards. In this case, this area of contamination concept allows you some flexibility with managing the contaminated soil within the boundaries of the AOC without triggering, okay, the land disposal restriction requirement. And that's a useful tool, a flexible tool that's used a lot in Superfund responses. It's only applicable to remediation wastes. That's an important thing to note on that. Finally, the last thing I'll talk about real briefly, and then I'll save a few minutes here for questions, is corrective action management unit. This is a special type of land-based unit. It's used typically for a large volume of remediation waste, hazardous remediation waste that it's not cost-effective to ship off-site for disposal. And EPA has provided standards for CAMAs. You can have a treatment-only CAMA, you can have a disposal, you can have storage-only corrective action management unit. Depending on the type of one that you're going to employ at your site, there are specific design standards for it. The important thing is CAMAs can be sited anywhere in your facility, in your cleanup. They can be in uncontaminated areas, or CAMAs can be sited where you have, say, some existing surface impoundments that you want to consolidate and clean up, and put a permanent disposal site where those surface impoundments currently exist. So again, a CAMU is used oftentimes where you have large volumes of hazardous waste or contaminated media that needs to be managed as hazardous waste, and it's a more cost-effective option to select and design a CAMU rather than try to send that waste stream off-site for disposal. Okay, that's, in order to save time, that's really about all I have to say. I apologize, we couldn't get to the rest of these slides. If there are questions on any of the materials that I didn't have time to go over, again, feel free to email me those. I will take a look at them and try to respond as best I can to you. Jean?
Sure.
I don't know at this point if you have more time.
Yeah, we could certainly take a moment or two to extend on it and take some additional questions. We did have two questions that came in relevant to some of the content that you were just speaking about. If participants are in the middle of typing up questions, you can continue to go ahead and submit them. And as I mentioned, if we can't address them live, we will work with our instructor to get an answer offline. But let me read out two of the questions that have come in already. The first one is asking about transportation under RCRA of hazardous waste. And they initially start out with the question to ask if RCRA deals with the interstate transportation of hazardous waste. And they ask for your suggestions if you have different definitions of hazardous waste between states that you would need to cross with the waste. They have a potential reuse for a particular waste, and they would need to cross several states to get it to their end user. but the initial state where the waste is originating is concerned that other states won't let the waste be transported across their lines, and so they're looking for words of advice of what they should do.
Yeah, typically, that's a good question, Eric. That's pretty complex. I can't give you a definitive yes or no answer without knowing a little more about the situation. I mean, some states, for example, go back to California, where they define a hazardous waste within the state, to say Nevada doesn't, because Nevada adheres to the federal definitions. But Nevada has put in a law that any waste they receive from California, if it's defined as a California state hazardous waste, it has to be managed as a hazardous waste in Nevada. So you get into an issue where, yeah, you have to look at the differences in the state and see how their regulatory programs resolve that. Typically, again, the initial determination is based on the applicable regulations within the state, and if the receiving state is different, you would need to check if the receiving state has some sort of requirement where they specify, okay, if it's defined as a hazardous waste in that state, but we don't define it as a hazardous waste, or the federal government doesn't define it as a hazardous waste, whether they're going to still require it to be managed as such in that state. That's the easiest way I guess I can kind of describe that that scenario for you, given the time I have. But again, feel free to submit a question. I'll be happy to take a little more in-depth look at it for you.
Okay, great. And then the next question we'll take online. We're going to switch for our participants. We're just going to go another 2 or 3 minutes beyond our scheduled end time, so hang in there with me, and I'll be sure to give you the normal closing information. But let's take this one last question online, and this particular user asks if you can comment about E or digital manifest. They wanted to know if EPA had moved that part of manifest and the record program to an electronic format, and if you could comment or talk a little bit about that, if that's true.
There was some work on that. They were doing work on that almost a decade ago, and I don't believe they've went to an electronic system like that. Again, I don't know if we have some folks who are over there, down there in Crystal City, who might want to comment on it. But as far as I know, they have not established. I know that there was some discussion, there was some pilot work being done on electronic manifests, but I am unaware that they put that in place at this present time. It's still using the paper manifests on that. Gene, I don't know if you have some folks there at headquarters who are listening in who might have more insight on that than I do.
Right. Okay. Again, I'll work with them to kind of circle back and get more detail to the participant if we can get additional information on that program. And I just want to be sure to give an opportunity to anybody who's on the telephone lines. If you're on the phones and would like to ask a question out loud, you're welcome to take yourself off of mute. If you've used our muting commands, you need to hit #6 to unmute, or you can simply unmute with your own mute button if that's what you used. Okay. Well, I don't see any additional questions in the online queue, and I don't hear anybody else speaking up. So I guess, Dave, if you want to take just 1 minute to make any kind of closing statements or thoughts, and then I'll be happy to walk everybody through the last items.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jean. I just want to thank everybody who, took their time to listen in here on the webinar. I hope you got something out of it. Recognize RCRA's, as you probably well know, it can be a rather difficult statute or regulatory program. Sometimes a little bit difficult talking over the phone here like that without seeing people's faces and, being able to answer your questions personally, directly like that. But I appreciate all of you who took the time to listen in. Again, I hope you got something out. Gene, if you want to pass me on, again, some questions that folks may still have, I'd be happy to take a look at them and try to provide them some information. For example, the person from Alabama who was asking why the contained in policy was an error under CERCLA, anything like that. I'll do my best to respond to you. And again, thank you, and I hope you all have a great day.
Great. Thanks so much, Dave. I appreciate it. And so with that, I'm going to go ahead and go through some closing statements here, and we'll talk about how we can follow up with additional questions, how you can reach out to myself as well as Dave. And get comments and feedback submitted and then get verification of your attendance today. I'm going to go ahead and direct everybody to move along to slide number 49. This is the resources and feedback form. A collection of materials has actually been pulled together for today's seminar, including a copy of the PowerPoint presentation, and you'll find that on something called the additional resources page. That should be hyperlinked on slide number 49. If you can't open that link, if you go back to the seminar homepage, you'll see links to that on the left side. There's a button that should say links or resources. You can click there and, again, download copies of the presentation material and other NARPM-related resources. The other link you'll find on slide 49 is a link to our short feedback form. A number of you have actually already started submitting it, and I appreciate that. If you haven't, though, take a moment, please, and go ahead and fill that out. It takes just a moment or two to submit your comments, and I do read each and every one of those. So if you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time or at least useful information, we welcome those comments. If you have thoughts of how we delivered it, moderating, or exactly what our speaker covered, again, any comments, good or bad, we welcome to hear that feedback. If you share the line with multiple parties, each individual person can actually submit their own feedback form. Once you fill the form out once, there's a link that'll pop up and let another person hop on and give their own feedback. If you are not actively at a computer, again, you'll find that same feedback form available from the seminar homepage. There'll be a button that says feedback on the side, and you can fill that feedback out anytime from this point forward. If you're one of the lucky individuals replaying this as part of our archive, you too can still submit feedback, so you can also follow the link to the feedback form and submit your feedback after the live delivery. If you're looking for verification or some sort of a certificate for participating today, we don't necessarily issue those through Clue-In, but you may find that if you take your registration email, a copy of the presentation materials, and that confirmation email, you can get one of those when you fill out feedback. You can check a box and actually have a confirmation email sent to you for your own records. If you take those three pieces of information, you may find that you can earn credit with your accrediting institution that will count towards whatever continuing education requirements that you have. So I'd encourage you to use those resources, and feel free to contact me if you need additional verification of your attendance today. I know we didn't have a lot of time to get through all of the materials. We've gone a little bit past our scheduled end time. I appreciate everybody hanging in there with us. We did have nearly 120 individuals join us today from all over the country. I will take a copy of all of the questions that have been submitted, and there were one or two that we weren't able to ask out loud, and I'll go ahead and forward those on to our presenter today so he can work to try to provide additional information. If you had supplemental information to any of the questions that you've already asked on today's seminar, you can feel free to reach out to me as well, and I'll be happy to take your input, especially if you're coming from one of the EPA record programs, and share that with our attendees. You can find contact information for myself as well as Dave Phillips on the seminar homepage. You'll find his email address as well as my own, and I'd encourage you guys to feel free to reach out to us at any point in time with additional questions or comments about the information you saw presented today. Again, this is the first seminar in the series, so there will be additional ones delivered through the Clue-In website. So if you're interested in taking part of more seminars like this, I'd encourage you to go to clueins.org and actually click on the link to our training. You can actually sign up for the other NARPM Presents seminars in the series. I apologize for going a little bit past our end time, but I do hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. I want to thank Dave Phillips for joining us today from TetraTech. Again, we've already gotten a lot of feedback, Dave, that you are a very knowledgeable presenter, and people really appreciated all of your information. And I do want to extend thanks to the, again, over 120 individuals who joined us from across the country today. I hope that this was a useful expenditure of your time, and that we'll either see you or hear from you on a future Clue-In seminar. You will automatically receive an email when the recorded version of today's session is available for free replay and download, and I'd encourage you to share it with your coworkers if you think they'll find it useful. This will be the formal conclusion for today's Clue-In seminar. I hope that you have a good rest of the day, and again, I'll either see you or hear from you on a future session. Thank you very much.